Today is December 21st, 2018, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, the Pope is calling on the church's priests who have sexually abused children to turn themselves in. We'll take a trip to what could be the world's largest Christmas store, and we'll mark one of mankind's most incredible adventures, a trek that was literally out of this world. It's all on today's International Edition. We begin today in Rome. Pope Francis Friday called on those who have sexually abused children to turn themselves in. He devoted a large part of his annual address to the governing Curia to the crisis that has rocked the Catholic Church. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome. Okay, we'll get to that a little later in the program. Among the top stories in the world, a methane explosion in a Czech coal mine killed 13 miners. Iraqi authorities have uncovered a new mass grave containing the remains of dozens of people in an area of northern Kirkuk province, once held by the Islamic State. Israel's military is destroying what it says are Hezbollah's terror tunnels built under the border with Lebanon. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you picture Saturn, you probably think of a planet surrounded by a spectacular system of rings. Now picture Saturn without those iconic rings. That's what could happen between 100 and 300 million years from now, according to recent research conducted by scientists at the UK's University of Leicester and NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. In the 1980s, after examining images from NASA's Voyager mission, scientists noticed three dark bands on Saturn. This led them to theorize that Saturn was shedding ring material in the form of water that rained on the planet. The new research team thinks that this ring rain, which they say is made up of dusty ice particles, is being pulled into Saturn along its magnetic field lines by the planet's gravity at a faster rate than had been thought. They theorize that this could cause Saturn's rings to completely disappear in 100 to 300 million years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
A tumultuous year in Afghanistan is ending with a renewed push and newfound hopes that the start of a dialogue with the Taliban may be in sight. The U.S. increased its air campaign in the country, leading to a rise in civilian casualties. But the Taliban gained territory. U.S. generals think Afghan military's losses are unsustainable. Meanwhile, the U.S. has started directly engaging the Taliban and regional countries to start a reconciliation process. Aisha Tanzim takes us through the ups and downs of Afghanistan in 2018.
The year started with a devastating wave of violence. A January attack on one of the city's premier hotels left dozens dead, including 14 foreigners. Days later, a Taliban attacker blew up an ambulance packed with explosives on a crowded street, killing at least 95. The attacks in the heart of the capital were one indication that a surge in American troops in the country to 14,000 from less than 10,000 last year had not helped. Civilians continued to die in record numbers, according to the United Nations. Afghan security forces' casualties were unsustainable, according to American generals. 12 Americans died in action. President Ashraf Ghani repeatedly offered Taliban to join peace talks.
We offer the Taliban a peace which guarantees Afghanistan's interests and women's rights and which prohibits any terrorism on Afghan soil.
But the insurgents continued to ignore him. They wanted to talk directly to what they called the occupying force, the Americans. The first pause in violence in the 17-year-old war came in June when Ghani offered 8 days of unilateral ceasefire to the Taliban. The Taliban reciprocated for 3 out of the 8 days, which coincided with the holy Muslim festival Eid al-Fitr. Unprecedented scenes of militants mingling with Afghan civilians, taking selfies and smiling at Afghan security personnel flooded social media, raising expectations of a major breakthrough.
Our leaders have ordered a 3-day ceasefire. We want a permanent ceasefire to resolve all our issues.
Then, in a major development over the summer, America reversed its long-standing policy. Senior U.S. diplomat Alice Wells held a face-to-face meeting with Taliban. It was followed by U.S. President Donald Trump officially nominating Zalmay Khalilzad to negotiate with all parties, including the Taliban.
The end state that I envisage for Afghanistan will be an Afghanistan that is at peace, an Afghanistan that's successful, an Afghanistan that doesn't pose a threat to itself, meaning there is peace among Afghans, and an Afghanistan that doesn't pose a threat to the international community, and since I represent the United States, particularly to the United States.
Khalilzad has since made 3 trips to the region. The Taliban have welcomed the development, but the contacts did little to reduce the violence. Taliban attacks left hundreds dead on both sides. Meanwhile, another group, Islamic State, continued attacking targets in Nangarhar province and Kabul city throughout the year. In between, the country held its long overdue parliamentary elections. Women came out in droves to vote despite threats. The year ended with a hope that negotiations with the Taliban may yield some result next year. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
And you're listening to International Edition. Here in Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump is in a showdown with Congress over keeping portions of the U.S. government open beyond today. This comes as members of both political parties and key allies are expressing concern over the resignation of Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Mr. Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Joining us to help sort through the many issues the Trump administration is dealing with is VOA's White House correspondent, Patsy Whitaker-Ruswara. Patsy, let's begin with the resignation of Defense Secretary Mattis. Why are people concerned about this?
Well, is a serious mistake. President Trump has declared victory over ISIS, even though the Pentagon and State Department for months now have been saying that the fight against the group in Syria is not over. So because they risk both at home and abroad, and even referred to him and who can control some of the president's extreme impulses, in particular some isolationist tendencies. So we do see this resignation as loss of stability and more uncertainty.
Okay, Patsy, we have a bad connection, so we're going to have to wrap this up now. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Patsy Whitaker-Ruswara at the White House. Thank you so much. 50 years ago, the U.S. space agency NASA launched one of the greatest adventures in human history, the first manned space mission to circle the moon. That mission, at the end of a tumultuous year of 1968, is considered one of the boldest and potentially dangerous missions in NASA's hurried effort to put a man on the moon before the decade ended. The three astronauts, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, were the first to escape Earth orbit and travel more than 386,000 kilometers to circle the moon 10 times, proving the feasibility of a manned mission to the lunar surface the following year. John Logsdon, a professor emeritus of political science and international affairs, headed the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. He told VOA's Victor Beatty, "In the midst of assassinations, the agony of Vietnam, and racial tensions, the Apollo 8 mission was a welcome respite."
Indeed. I think one columnist said, "You saved the year." It was a very positive and exciting culmination to what had been a horrible year.
This really was the first time that man pulled away from Earth orbit.
Yes, this was the first time that humans went any further than a few hundred miles away from the surface of the Earth. They went 240,000 miles away.
What were the chances, according to the wife of Mr. Borman, his wife demanded to know the crew's chances. A NASA director said 50-50.
Well, I think that was an exaggeration. Probably 50-50 of the mission being a total success, but I don't think NASA would have launched or the crew would have agreed to be launched with even odds. It was a risky and very gutsy choice, but it wasn't that risky.
The calendar was breathing down the neck of NASA, wasn't it, to fulfill former President Kennedy's admonition to complete a landing on the moon by the end of the 1960s. This was truly a risky mission in many ways.
Well, in many ways. And there was another threat, which was that our intelligence agency, the CIA, had said that there was a high likelihood that the Soviet Union would try to send a cosmonaut around the moon, not into lunar orbit, but looping around the moon before the end of the year. So there was a possibility that Russia, not the United States, would be first to the moon. That was one of the factors, and the fact that the lunar module wasn't ready for its test was another factor that made the decision in August, just 4 months before the mission, to send this mission around the moon was the boldest decision, I think, in the history of the Apollo program.
So this was a revolutionary flight in many ways.
In many ways. It was the first launch with a crew of the Saturn V. It was the first journey beyond low Earth orbit for humans. It gave us eyes on the far side of the moon, tested out all the systems needed for a lunar landing except the landing itself, and gave us the Earthrise picture as kind of an unexpected bonus.
Lovell, of course, who went on to command the ill-fated Apollo 13, said Apollo 8 was a mission of exploration, the one of repeating the Lewis and Clark expedition finding the new Earth. What did he mean?
Well, it was going new places. That's what exploration is. And humans had never been in the vicinity of the moon before. So it was truly going someplace that human beings had never been before.
John Logsdon says the likelihood of returning to the moon in the next decade is better than 50-50. You're listening to International Edition from VOA. And we're joined once again by VOA White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suara. Patsy, right now, you're on a stakeout for words from Senate Republicans about the likelihood of a shutdown of the U.S. government at midnight tonight. How likely is this partial government shutdown to happen?
Well, it really just depends on what the president will do, Jim. And you're correct. And I do apologize for earlier because I'm here amongst all these journalists and we're under a lot of signals right here. But the House Republicans did vote for a spending bill with border wall funding. But, you know, there's just no way it will pass in the Senate. And right now we're just waiting to hear from the Senate Republicans who are currently meeting with President Trump. And we're just at this point really looking for an option of whether the Republicans can just go to the president and say, we tried, we failed. And then the president may be concerned to his supporters, who is very concerned about border security, and say, look, we gave it all we got, but those Democrats just won't budge. We have absolutely no idea what's going to happen, whether the president will finally blink maybe and say, let's take up this fight again in 2019. Will he do that or not? Your guess is as good as mine.
Well, the uncertainty of government funding, and as we discussed earlier, the resignation of Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, leaves a lot of instability right now in Washington. What effect is it having on the rest of the world?
Well, certainly it's impacting the global stocks market. It has been extremely volatile this month. Just the Dow alone lost over 1,200 points this week and 2,700 points in December. Maybe this is the worst December since the recession, and its impact is felt in markets in Asia and Europe. But beyond that, also allies as well as adversaries are very anxious that Secretary Mattis's departure means more uncertainty. They are concerned that the world will become more unstable, more vulnerable to conflict. I believe a former prime minister of Sweden described it as a warning of alarm in Europe. And this is somewhat accurate because the Syria withdrawal was not consulted with allies, was not consulted with Israel as well. And it's certainly going to create a lot of geopolitical shifts in the Middle East. The planned withdrawal from Afghanistan is also shocking to many leaders around the world. It's also shocking to the Afghanis who just woke up with this news. So, again, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of volatility happening towards the end of this year.
Patsy, you may be the busiest reporter in Washington today. We appreciate you taking time to talk with us. Thank you. You're listening to International Edition from VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This is VOA's International Edition. Still to come, the story of one of the holiday's most popular songs. But first, we travel to the northern U.S. state of Michigan to visit Bronner's Christmas Wonderland. At more than 1 hectare under one roof, it promotes itself as the largest Christmas store in the world. Erica Celeste visited the store for a tour through the eyes of some of its smallest customers.
Visiting Bronner's Christmas Wonderland is more than a shopping trip. It's an experience. At roughly the size of 8 Olympic swimming pools, it's a lot for siblings Rollin and Rain Martorello to grasp.
It's huge. That's all I can say. It's really huge.
A trip to Bronner's often starts with a commemorative photo. From there, customers are given a map to help navigate the store. Dazzling lights and outdoor decor cascade from the ceilings that had to be raised to accommodate the taller Christmas tree displays. Rollins says he likes the old-fashioned Dickens characters, Christmas villages, and nutcrackers that cover the showroom floor. But the modern electronic displays are the best.
My favorite thing is the snowman turned on.
We have over 50,000, just over 50,000 items here. Everything from artificial trees and wreaths and garlands, all kinds of lighting, the LED lights. We have ornaments. We have about 8,000 styles of ornaments. About 1,500 of those can be personalized.
In fact, says Media Relations Chief Lori Lipka, the ornaments are the stars of the store. Everything from hand-blown glass baubles to sports-themed pieces and even movie motif ornaments. A definite favorite are the international ornaments, which makes sense because the store guestbook reflects visitors from more than 100 countries.
We do see a lot of international folks, and it's not unusual to walk around and to hear several languages being spoken any given day this time of year.
Founder Wally Bronner was a teenager when he started a sign painting business. After a businessman asked him to create Christmas signs for the city of Clare, Michigan, he recognized a niche market and in 1945 opened a store specializing in the holiday. Because his faith and family were important to him, Bronner worked tirelessly to blend the religious meaning of Christmas with the commercial aspect.
Hi, Rollin.
Hi.
He also made sure Bronner's was a place for customers of all ages to enjoy. That's why young customers who need a break from shopping can visit with Santa.
You know, I like being at Bronner's because it gives me a chance to really talk about what Christmas means. You know, and I give out one of those little ornaments that has Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus.
Because the store is open 361 days a year, it's the one place kids of all ages can get a little Christmas anytime they want.
What's the way to dance?
For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Frankenmuth, Michigan.
That sounds like a fun store to visit. Well, you know, music is a big part of celebrating the holiday season. There are traditional songs that date back hundreds of years and more contemporary music from today's biggest stars. One of the most popular songs year after year was written just after World War II about a reindeer who didn't quite fit in.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is one of the most loved holiday songs in the U.S. and around the world. First recorded by Gene Autry in 1949, it has since been performed by hundreds of singers in many different languages. The song was written by composer Johnny Marks, who died in 1985. He is best known for his many Christmas songs, including Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree and Holly Jolly Christmas.
Have a holly jolly Christmas, and in case you didn't hear, oh, by golly, have a holly jolly Christmas.
But Rudolph was his biggest hit. It was inspired by a poem by Robert May. Before his death, he took time to talk about his career. He said he didn't like his first try at the famous song.
Well, it'd be simpler if I just show you what I didn't like by playing it, because the original tune went, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Well, as I played it over, it just didn't sound like much of a tune to me, and I just didn't like it.
But then, a couple of years later, he started humming a tune on the street, one that would become very familiar.
Well, I think you recognize that, but you'll see it's the original tune in reverse, because the first one went, put it in reverse. At any rate, after I had that opening strain and I came across...
Mark's favorite part of the song is the opening verse because, as he says, it sets the whole picture for the song.
You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
The song has gone on to inspire a TV special and a feature film. And the song, like the reindeer, will go down in history. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News. And that is certainly one of my favorite holiday songs. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our team here today, Director Patrice Martin, Engineer Nick Ivanoff, and I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great day.
Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen. But do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
The song is going...